From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With the new year, we pledge to slim down, get in shape, fit back into our favorite skinny jeans. Losing weight is hard, okay, but it turns out keeping the pounds off is even harder. Yes, it's bad habits that kick in, but fascinating emerging science says it is also our bodies themselves fighting hard to gain back every pound in full battle mode to fatten up again. This hour on Point, science, the battle of the bulge, and what it takes to win. You can join the conversation. Have you ridden the weight yo-yo up and down, up and down? Have you felt your body fighting your best efforts? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now is Tara Parker Pope, creator and writer of Well, a daily health blog and weekly column for the New York Times. Her cover story in this past Sunday's Times Magazine was The Fat Trap. She joins us from the studios of the Classical Network in Princeton, New Jersey. Tara Parker Pope, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What a terrific story this was. And if people didn't know already, just kind of in their bones, you really laid it out for us that, hard as it is to sweat off the pounds, there's a whole armada of sort of physical effects waiting in our body to fight back when we do. What does that look like? What happens, Tara?
So much happens. And I think every dieter maybe feels like their body is fighting against them, but we're told so consistently, just eat less and move more. If you just believe, if it's just about willpower. And I think the science shows that it's so much more complicated than that. Our brains change. Once the body drops to about 10% of its body weight, that's when this full force of this effect kicks in. So if you lose 10 pounds, if you lose 30 pounds, it's all the same. Your brain changes. You look at food differently. You crave it more. You have less restraint. They've done brain scans where they see that the parts of the brain that deal with, restraint, there's less activation after you've lost weight. I mean, a weight-reduced body is different than a body of the same size that hasn't lost weight to get there.
Take us into some more of the mechanics of that and what's going on there, whether it's metabolism or hormones, leptin you write a lot about. Give us some of the details of how the body arrays itself when you start losing that weight.
Well, there are there's a host of hormones that regulate hunger and body weight. And what has been shown fairly recently is that a full year after dieting has stopped, so these people are no longer dieting, they're just trying to eat normal and maintain a weight. Once that's happened, the levels of leptin, which have not returned to normal, and leptin, you feel more hungry, and your body, your brain is sending signals to your body to put on weight. A hunger hormone called ghrelin is not at normal levels. There's a host of other chemicals, body chemicals and hormones that have changed. Other research has shown that your muscles have changed. They've literally changed after you've lost weight to become more efficient so that you may think that that brisk walk, you're burning 200 calories on that walk. Mm-hmm. You're probably only burning about 150 calories on that walk, that somebody of your same weight would burn a higher level. And what the research has shown is that a weight-reduced body is at a disadvantage that translates to about 300 to 400 calories. So if you take two people who are 160 pounds and one of them lost weight to get there, and one of them has really maintained that weight naturally. Mm-hmm. The person who dieted is at a 300 to 400 calorie disadvantage compared to the other person.
For daily intake. They have to take that much less in every day to maintain that 160-pound level.
Or do that much more exercise, mm-hmm. both of which are very difficult to do. And so I think what's really important about this is that we really need to think differently about weight loss and people with weight struggles because, the attitude is like, well, if they would just, show a little restraint, if they would just eat like everybody else, I can do it. Why can't they? Well, if you've never had a weight problem, if you've never lost weight to maintain your current weight, you have a different sort of set of rules for your body than somebody who has been in this, dieting yo-yo that you talked about.
And yet, the problem is still there for the individual and for society. I mean, a lot of people live with weight and live well with weight, but we know the afflictions that come along with it in terms of health and diabetes. And, I mean, you write a lot about this, Tara. It's not as though, in spite of the difficulty of it, we don't need to or want to get those weights down.
I don't think we should give up on people who are overweight. 60% of the population is overweight. But in that 60%, you have some people who are morbidly obese, some people who are obese, and some people who are just, technically overweight. It is certainly possible to be fit and fat. There are a lot of data to show that. I think the first step for these people is to take care of the body that they have, to eat well, to exercise, and just take care of the body they have. Overweight people, if you're a little bit overweight, that's not necessarily, you know, there are some data to show those people actually live longer. So I think the people who really feel desperate are the people who are obese and who are very much overweight, and they are really experiencing the social stigma of being fat. And we certainly don't want to give up on those people, but I think we're not doing them any favors by saying that it's easy. Anybody can do it. It's not easy. It's a whole life change that's required to lose weight and keep it off.
I mean, but that attitude is very vivid out there. Here online, we've got all kinds of response. But here Ted says, you know, hey, exercise more, eat less, stop relying on magic to shed weight, tough love, overdue in this discussion, move your butt. That's a very common attitude here. You're saying, wait a minute, let's look at the chemistry.
I'm saying pay attention to the facts. And yes, eat less, move more. It's not that simple. A person who has a weight problem and who tries to lose weight has to eat a lot less and move a lot more. The amount of discipline and the amount of exercise and restricted eating that's required for that person is so different. And you know, there's two kind. I've gotten sort of several different responses from this article. Mm-hmm. I have heard comments like that going, oh, you're just being too easy on people. I've heard from a lot of people who said, you know what, for the first time now I understand what my wife or my husband or my friend is going through, because I go to lunch with them and I see that they're eating fine, but they're really struggling with weight. And I think that once you understand that the person with a weight problem has a different rule book for eating and exercise, then maybe we can show them more compassion. And it is true that people who are overweight have overeaten to get there, because obviously their body didn't need that many calories. But it's not necessarily gluttony that plays a role. I mean, there are genetic studies that show people gain weight at different rates. It's really quite fascinating. You can feed people the same amount and they will gain different amounts of weight.
We'll look at that. But first, and we're going to talk in this hour with a scientist who you know well, who's deep into all these issues around weight and how we might, maybe, it sure would be great, someday put some of these chemicals to work on our side instead of against us. But have you, from the scientists who focus on this, Tara, have they given you a sort of evolutionary, biological explanation of why the body would want to hang on, it seems, to every ounce and fight to get it back, even when it's long gone? What's the advantage in that?
Well, during times of famine, during cold winters when there was very little food, for, you know, women who were nursing a baby, there were all kinds of advantages to keeping fat on your body. And so we can understand why people in, you know, the very, you know, 1,000 years ago, you know, however many years ago you want to go back, why it would be advantageous to hold on to your fat, because there were food was not plentiful. What's a lot of people are very confused, because they're saying, well, our genes haven't changed, and you know, why are we fat now? It's only a fairly recent phenomenon. And no, our genes have been the same. Our genes, I mean, genetically, or the human body likes to hold on to its fat. But what has changed in the past 30 years is food is incredibly plentiful. I mean, even our grandparents during the Depression didn't have access to as much food as we have today. In times of plenty, when food is abundant and there's no sort of outside forces taking food away from us, then the negative expression of these genes kicks in. And there's, there is a fat gene, and there's probably many, many fat genes. But what happens is that in the right set of circumstances, those are triggered and we gain weight. And not everybody has them, but a lot of people do.
Tara Parker Pope is writing about what she calls the fat trap. Let's bring our listeners in, Tara. Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air with Tara.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
You just took a little of my thunder away with the last comment, but I still don't think it's borne out well enough. When I grew up in the 60s and the 50s and the 70s and for decades before that, she said that food is more plentiful right now, but we ate just fine in the 60s and the 70s. Mm-hmm. We ate meatloaf and macaroni and cheese and spaghetti and fried chicken.
Yeah, yeah.
And I could count on one hand the number of overweight kids in my elementary school.
It was rare.
It was rare, and we were eating, and nobody ate health food. You couldn't find a loaf of whole wheat bread to save your life. We were eating white pasta.
Yeah.
What is different between then and now that has caused this to happen? I agree with all the science. I agree with everything that she's saying,
yeah,
hormones and leptin. But something, I ate like a grown man when I was 10 years old, and I was a beanpole, and all my friends were beanpoles, and there wasn't a fat adult on my block. And if you watch the movie Woodstock from 1969, you don't see a fat person in 500,000 people.
Yeah.
So something has happened besides the science because evolution doesn't change us that much in 30 years.
Kevin, I'm on the same beam with that question. Our time is short before the break, but Tara, what about it? You know, look back at Woodstock, 500,000 people, and everybody's a beanpole, or at least it seems that way. I mean,
they weren't starving. The environment has changed. I mean, the foods that are now, you know, processed foods, commercial foods, fast foods are much more energy dense than they used to be. Larger portions are now served. So people might have had a fast food meal in the 60s, but the size of that meal is now much greater. There's so many more calories per serving. Plates have gotten bigger. And we know there was some recent data showing that even the amount of activity during our job day has declined dramatically in the past 50 years. 80% of jobs are now pretty much sedentary, and that's a big difference than 50 years ago. So you have to understand that this is not a mistake of thousands and thousands of calories. This is a mistake of 50 to 100 calories a day that can trigger too much weight gain in a year. So it doesn't have to be a huge change. A small change can be the explanation for obesity.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about why it's so hard to lose weight and keep it off. The science of our bodies battling our own best intentions on weight. The whole country thinks about it a lot, and maybe particularly this time of year, New Year's resolutions. Here's a little bit from the premiere of season 13 now, The Biggest Loser. Emily, former athlete, starts the season at 264 pounds, weighs in here after the first week of workouts.
A week and 10 pounds. That's good.
You're not used to feeling proud of yourself?
No. No, I'm really proud of myself. It means I'm 10 pounds closer to the athlete that I was.
Emily really does have such a competitive nature with herself. I love that about you, Emily.
Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
10 pounds. Emily's lost that at 264, and she's weeping about it. We want it that badly. Our emotions are all invested here, but there's science, too. Tara Parker Pope writes about it in The Fat Trap in the New York Times Sunday magazine. She's with us today from Princeton, New Jersey. We're going to hear in just a moment from a big doctor in this field with a lot of insight on what's going on there. Tara, this makes it sound like, you know, you gain weight once in your life, have one sort of season of being overweight, and that's your new high watermark, and you're in trouble because your body is always going to want that again. Do I read you right?
Well, it depends. I mean, I think there are some instances, obviously, of transient weight gain. Maybe you gained 10 or 15 pounds during college or during your first year of marriage. And there are lots of examples of people who found a way to drop that weight and keep it off. The body in that situation apparently didn't really reset itself to the higher weight.
Okay.
What we see is that the body likes to kind of reset up, but it doesn't ever, that we know of, reset down. So you, depending on your genetics, you know, your behavior, how much weight you've gained and how long you've had it on, that will affect. We don't really know what it is. It's probably, you know, a year of being overweight may not be enough to permanently reset your body. But we don't really know what it is, but we just do know that some people who are, you know, certainly prone to obesity do have a harder time. But there are definitely instances of transient weight gain that can be taken off. But we're talking about people who really have a chronic weight problem and have really battled it for years. And those are the people that, you know, you compare it to alcoholism. I think I would compare it more to something like, I don't know, high blood pressure or diabetes. You know, those people have to work every day to take care of their bodies. Somebody with epilepsy, for instance, has to be fully committed to their health. They might adopt a very strict diet. I would say that obesity falls in this range of health conditions. It's a disease, and it's one that requires active, constant, lifelong treatment.
But this does help explain what we see when we look around, what you cited in the numbers there. You go back in history, I guess far fewer people would have had a time between a little less dense, high-calorie food on the table and just floating around and a more active lifestyle. People just wouldn't have that couple of years of being overweight at some point in their life. It would just be less likely overall, I guess, Tara.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think we fully understand why the population has gained weight, but we do know, you know, a researcher at Yale calls it the toxic food environment. We know that a lot has changed. But I think even individually, we can see in our own lives, you know, during times, I know for me, I was a very active high school athlete. I was still very active
cross-country
in college.
Runner and all the works.
I was, and I was, you know, there were times where I was putting in, you know, 70 miles a week for, that was back in the day when they pretty much killed you during cross-country training. Yeah. And, you know, I went on, you know, 16-mile runs on the weekends, and I was a very active kid. And then as I got older, I continued to run, but my activity went down, and I socialized more. I was probably eating out more, drinking more, probably not eating as well because I was, you know, grabbing quick bites and eating M&Ms to stay awake for exams and all the things you do in college. I didn't get fat at that point, but I put on 10 pounds. And then, you know, over time, you know, you get busy, you work. One of the triggers is definitely having a baby for women, gaining that pregnancy weight. A lot of women, their bodies change and they feel like they can't lose the weight. So there are all kinds of explanations. And I think we focus so much sometimes on why people have gained weight. And I think that's an important area of study. But I think what we need to understand and why I wrote the story is that there's so much blame placed on a person who is overweight or obese. And there's a lot of self-blame. There's a lot of self-loathing. And I think what's been really exciting to me is the mail that I've gotten from people who say, you know, now I understand. I understand my own body and my own life. And even though you're telling me this is going to be very, very hard, I'm actually very optimistic. I feel like now I know what the challenge is. I just had the wrong information before, and I just thought it was my fault. And now that I know that I have this condition, maybe now I'm equipped to actually really tackle it and really try to do better.
You're very candid. This is a big, long story. You tell us a lot about science. You tell us a good deal about yourself. I mean, all that athletic history of yours, fantastic. But you write that you say, you know, I'm to the point now where I'm easily, you're right, 60 pounds overweight. So how does your new insight leave you feeling about that? I mean, later in your article, you say, you know, there may be treatments one day. They may be able to roll out some of these hormones that will help suppress appetite in a healthy way. But for now, you write, Tara, those of us who want to lose weight and keep it off are on our own. So you got 60 pounds plus you'd presumably like to be rid of, wouldn't mind being rid of. Now you know this science. How does it leave you looking at that weight and your capacity to maybe whack it down and keep it down?
Well, I think it'll be difficult, and I think that the first step for any person who has a weight problem, it was very difficult to write about this, to, you know, sort of be open. I'm a health writer, and people certainly have an expectation of health writers, but,
be
you know,
healthy.
I'm just like, well, I am healthy is the thing. Yeah, that's what I think is important.
Yep.
You know, all the regular markers, I am very healthy, but I am overweight. And so I think for me, I like having the information. I find it empowering. I feel optimistic because these things that were happening before, when the scale would move up and I would tell myself, I know what I've been eating. I know that I'm exercising. Why is it not helping? And now I realize I wasn't exercising enough. You know, 30, 40 minutes a day isn't going to cut it. And not for me, not for my body. And the amount that I was reducing food was probably not enough, even though it looked like enough compared to other people.
Right.
So I think having the information has made me very optimistic because I feel like, okay, it's going to be difficult. I have to be ready. I have to make sure I have the time. You know, I'm a single parent. It's, you know, anybody who has got a lot of challenges in their life, and I actually have a great life, but there are people who work two jobs, who have big families, who have a sick family member maybe. You know, I think those people just need to be reassured that the best thing they can do for themselves is to take care of the body that they have, that you can be healthy and be overweight. You should exercise because it makes you feel great. And then when you have the opportunity, if you can really commit to this, it's not, to call it a lifestyle change, I think, is an understatement. It's a whole life change. It can be done, but it's hard.
I mean, I have to say, I mean, I'm a natural way guy in every possible way that we can do it. But when I read what you write here about what it takes for those who have been significantly overweight and then bring their weight down, for them to keep it down, I mean, it's an ascetic lifestyle. It sounded almost an anorexic lifestyle. It made me sort of want to grab for a bottle of drugs that would do it. It looks so difficult. We'll talk about that, but what did you learn in your reporting that it takes, once you've lost it, to keep it down for people who are quite successful at it as a group?
There is a group that's been studied of about 10,000 people who've lost at least 30 pounds for 3 years, and they've kept it off. But most of the people in this group have lost maybe 60, 70 pounds. And I interviewed several people who'd been, you know, 300 pounds, and they're down to maybe 160, 180, one woman was at 195 and trying to maintain 130-pound weight loss. And what they have to do is incredible. You know, they get up every morning, they think every minute about what they're eating, about their weight and their exercise. And a lot of people have responded and said, well, is this sort of disordered eating? Is it like anorexia? I don't think that's fair. If these people had cancer or diabetes or epilepsy, nobody would criticize them. They would say, wow, they're really taking charge of their health. And that's all these people are doing. They're weighing every morning. They're weighing and measuring their food. They're being very careful with how much they eat and when they eat and the types of food they eat. They're happy people because they feel really good in their new smaller body, but it is a lot of work. They exercise. Some of these people exercise 2 hours a day. I don't think I touch anybody who exercises less than about 90 minutes a day. And they write down everything they eat. They really keep track. They're very accountable. It's not to say they don't ever make mistakes, but again, I think that daily accountability is what helps them, and they find lots of different ways to fit exercise into their day. A lot of them will ride the bike to the post office. A lot of these people have changed their lives, and they've switched into an area of fitness and health. Maybe they've become a nutritionist. Or I know a lot of the Biggest Losers, if you look at those people, a lot of them have gained the weight back. Those that haven't, a lot of them have started doing, you know, fitness consulting or public speaking. They've really
put it right at the center of their lives. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And that is what it takes.
It's incredible discipline, incredible changes that it can take. Tara Parker Pope with The New York Times is with us. We're going to hear in just a moment from Dr. Rudolf Leibel, who's right in the middle of all this and the science here. Let's go to our callers. Portland, Connecticut. David is calling. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. I was curious whether your guest could comment on stress. A couple of years ago, I lost both my parents while going through divorce. I don't remember changing anything. And it seemed like the weight just fell off. I wasn't even trying.
Stress and weight loss. Tara,
I didn't change my habits.
Your habits didn't change, but the weight went away. Tara, what do you know?
You know, I'm probably not the best person to ask. I have written about cortisol and stress and weight loss and weight gain. I think everybody's different how they respond to stress. Some people in stressful situations eat more. They're less conscientious about eating. You may say that you didn't change anything, but obviously something changed. You know, we know that in some people, they are naturally more fidgety. So they're not necessarily getting more exercise, but those little subtle movements, they're just moving a little bit more. And maybe the stress of your life was affecting how much you sat, how much you stood, how much you paced, maybe the time that you got up in the morning. There's any number of things that could have happened. But some people, you might have just eaten slightly less. You know, you've been a little less interested in food, a little less interested in I don't know, certain foods. Some people, though, during high times of stress, they really crave ice cream and fatty foods and certain foods, and they gain weight. So I don't think there's any one answer.
We'll put that to Dr. Leibel in just a moment. One more first here, Patty in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Patty, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I just can't tell you how much I appreciate hearing this show because I grew up as kind of a heavy kid, and it still bothers me. And I lost weight as a teenager and kept it off in my 20s and gained it after babies and was heavy. And I had to make a really strict effort in my late 30s to take about 30 pounds off. And this is where I relate to her. I know that I do more than the average person I see that stays my weight or young or that's less weighs less than me. I eat stricter and I have to exercise so much more, and it goes on so fast. And I've kept my weight down and my body fat low, and I've run marathons and I've become very athletic. But my question is, what bothers me is that I've watched my kids. I have a teenage son and I have a 9-year-old girl, and I try to feed them healthy without being ridiculously strict. My son started off heavy, my oldest, and my doctor got on me a lot because that's the thing to do now. And I got on him a lot, and then I could see him getting self-conscious about his weight. And he's now 14, and he's thinned out. My kids will never be sticks, and I never was either, but he eats a lot, and he loves to eat. But I watch my daughter. She's 9, and she's heavy for her age, but she eats much better than him. She doesn't eat as much. She eats slow. She doesn't crave sweets, but she's still growing the exact same way he did and I did and my dad did, and we got tall. We're tall, thinner now, but I think it will always be a struggle. What bothers me is I'm trying to keep my pediatrician at bay with her to not say things in front of her about where she is on the charts. Because I want her to have good self-esteem. I'm like I did at that
age. Right. And yet I can hear at the same time you want her to be healthy for life.
Right. And I'm more concerned with her eating healthy and exercising. Mm-hmm. I don't want her to worry about her weight because I know what that did to me. But what I do get afraid of is if I'm making a mistake, because they've pushed me to have her see a nutritionist and stuff, because I think, well, maybe the outside forces are going to fight her more than they did me because of the time period, the cultural period with the food and the sedentary stuff. Like, even though everything I try to instill, but I don't want to make an issue of it at her age, particularly a girl, because I went through a period of anorexia in my teen years. What should I do? Should I be really concerned? Should I stick to my guns and just... not force
it. Oh, Patty, I hear that question so vividly, and as a parent, I who couldn't understand it and relate to it. Let us pick it up, if we may, and Tara, stand by. This is a good time to bring in Dr. Rudolf Leibel. He joins us from New York, professor of diabetes research, professor of pediatrics and medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Leibel, thanks so much for being here today.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, there's a lot we want to ask you about, but if we could just go to Mother Patty's question first, and you hear she's got 14 and 9-year-old children, her 9-year-old daughter. She, you know, there's some extra weight there, but she doesn't want to get inside her brain and make her all self-conscious and ruin her self-esteem, and yet there's pressure from the doctor to have her take it off, and she's looking for advice. What do you say to her?
Well, I think Patty's attitude sounds about right to me. I think you have to be very, very careful in situations like this that you don't push a child into a situation in which you get into issues with their ability to follow what you think are important and relevant instructions, and which may, in fact, cause the child to develop issues with their own self-esteem, as she mentioned, and ultimately even get children slipping into anorectic-type behaviors. I think the issue here, the problem is that we don't fully understand. We don't understand a great deal about the development of obesity in children, when the critical periods are, what to do about trying to prevent obesity in families in which it's a problem. And I think at the present time, a judicious and very cautious approach to this without emphasizing rather draconian efforts to control body weight is the right way to go. I think you're doing the right thing. You try to instruct children and educate them about healthy habits in terms of eating and trying to increase or promote physical activity. And then basically, I think you have to lay back and just watch them along.
You know, Dr. Leibel, I hear that loud and clear, and what parent wouldn't want to hit that right balance? On the other hand, everything we're reading here from Tara Parker Pope, and you're quoted at some length in her article, is saying, you know, you set some high marks for weight, and then all your life you're going to have to battle those as a parent. Then you look at your children and say, oh my gosh, I don't want to set them up for a lifelong battle with some reset to an overweight point, doctor.
So that's a correct observation. The issue is, in relationship to the article, which I actually think is a very important one and very well done, is that we don't know what the critical developmental period is for establishing body weight in adulthood. For example, there's not a very strong correlation between obesity at age 2 or 3 or 4 and whether a child will end up being obese. There's a much better correlation between teenage obesity and adult obesity. So I think you have to temper an interest in trying to, quote, prevent obesity. And we really don't know if that's possible at all. But to the extent that it is, perhaps the emphasis should be early in life, as in the two children that are mentioned earlier, a modest and sort of judicious approach with increasing, I think, emphasis on weight control as children enter the age of puberty, for example. Again, we don't fully understand this, so it's not possible to give cogent or at least sort of fully informative advice. But I think caution is the right thing to emphasize in this, and not getting overly aggressive about trying to control weight in a child.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about why it's so hard to lose weight and keep it off, the science of our bodies, battling our own best intentions on weight. Tara Parker Pope is with us from the New York Times. Her big story in the magazine on Sunday was The Fat Trap. Dr. Rudolf Leibel is with us, Rudy Leibel, at the Columbia University Medical Center, co-director of the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center, executive director of the Berry Program in Cellular Therapies of Diabetes, knows the chemistry inside and out here, and also the very large human angle on this. I guess it's all human. Lots of comments and questions here, Tara and Rudy. Megan writes, you know, thinking about it as a lifelong battle is actually working against my progress. She asks, any thoughts on how to get past that? We'll come to that. Here's another from Jay who says, and I'll put this to you, Rudy Leibel, do we know Jay asks, if genetic switches that might turn on a fat gene, quote unquote, are transmitted through to offspring in the already on position if the parent is obese. Dr. Leibel?
We know that there are in humans at least 50 genes that have an effect on degree of obesity. These genes are passed from parent to child, just like other genes. And whether or not the status of those genes, for example, in a parent who is transmitting them, for example, whether they may be turned on or activated during pregnancy or gestation, is a very, very interesting question that we're now studying very intensively, because what this would suggest, what the caller's question suggests, is that if you have a genetic predisposition by virtue of inheriting these genes from a parent, and if the parent, for example, your mother is obese during the pregnancy, mm-hmm. will that do something to the activity of these genes that will make you even more likely to become obese? We have very scanty evidence in humans, better evidence in animals, including primates, monkeys, mm-hmm. that what I just said is in fact the case. That is, that the status of the parent, in particular in this case the mother, during the gestation, during the pregnancy, may actually influence the likelihood of obesity in offspring. And if that offspring has in addition a genetic predisposition to become obese, it may accelerate the process.
Interesting. Interesting. Tara, what about Megan's comment that, you know, thinking about it as a lifelong battle is working against her progress?
I don't know what to tell you because, you know, it's just the way it is. And I think that you are not helped. If I tell you that if you lose 50 pounds, that's all you have to do, then that 50 pounds is going to come back very quickly. For me personally, and I think for a lot of people, mm-hmm. understanding that this is the body I have and I want to mm-hmm. take care of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people are born with other problems, and I'm actually kind of grateful that I'm overall pretty healthy. Mm-hmm. This is a challenge, but at the same, you know, it is a surmountable challenge. I mean, you will be able to do this under the right set of circumstances. And if you can't do it, then like I said, take care of the body that you have. But, you know, I think it's wrong just to sort of sugarcoat this and say it's just if you believe you can drop the weight and you'll be fine. We have, you know, 80 to 95% of dieters in this country fail, depending on what, and I hate even the word fail, but the diet doesn't work for them. Mm-hmm. The weight comes back. Mm-hmm. 5 to 20% of people, depending on the study you look at, actually do find a way. Wow. I think we can learn from those people and they mm-hmm. can give us hope, but we have to learn from them. We can't kind of put our heads in the sand.
Scott in Brockton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Scott.
Hi, guys. How are you today?
Okay. What's your experience?
I'm kind of in a confused position. I came into a lot of stress in my life about, I don't know, 8 years ago.
Okay.
Started eating crazy. Put on about 25, 30 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed as if, even with the negative eating habits, I hit this point where if I stayed in that certain area, I didn't gain more. Mm-hmm. Just stayed at that plateau about 250.
Okay.
And then in the last 3 months, I started trying to get back in control, reel in my eating again, and I did. I lost 12 pounds.
Good for you. That's a big deal.
It is a big deal. Now, but for the last 3 weeks or 2.5 weeks, I've maintained the strict diet that I have over the 3 months, and I can't seem to lose another pound.
Yeah.
I've hit this wall, and as I said, I'm confused, and I wonder if anybody had any input on that.
Dr. Leibel, are there walls in the course of weight loss when people are working on it like Scott is? Does that make sense to you, or should he just, you know, will it happen if he keeps at it?
Yeah, Scott's observation is a very common one of hitting plateaus or thresholds, as some people refer to them, where the weight just seems to stop coming off. There are a number of reasons for this, of which probably the most important is that as the body loses weight, you have to obviously be in what we call negative energy balance. That is, you have to be eating less calories than you're spending.
Mm-hmm.
The body is beginning to accommodate itself and to enter a more efficient metabolic state, so that some of the things that were discussed in the article in the Times are actually occurring during the process of weight loss. So your body is actually beginning to buck your very good intention of continuing to lose weight. And for periods of time, you will come into a new equilibrium where, by virtue of the reduced energy expenditure that's occurring, your food intake now is pretty much matching that. And there are, what you really have to do under those circumstances is increase your amount of energy expenditure, meaning more physical activity, and reduce your energy intake even further. And if you do that, the weight will then begin to come down again. This is basically very straightforward physics. I mean, it's a question of balancing intake and expenditure, and as you lose weight, your body invokes a series of processes that actually help it to defend itself against the weight loss.
And are you saying we just have to exercise and diet our way past those? There's no trick that makes it. I mean, does Scott have to pick up his, you know, eat even less, exercise even more to get through that, or just stick at it steady state and hope it'll go down?
So in the long run, he's got to do exactly what you said. He's got to actually pick up the level of activity that he is invoking against mm-hmm. his body weight. There oh. are reasons, actually, with regard to water retention, where you may get relatively short periods of stability of body weight. But if this persists over several weeks, the problem is the one that I articulated, which is that you now have reached a new equilibrium state and have to do something to put yourself back into negative energy balance.
You know, I wish we could drill in on the chemistry here a little more, Dr. Leibel. Tara writes a lot about leptin, which this is the hormone that suppresses hunger, increases metabolism, which would, both of those things would obviously help take off or keep off weight. I mean, I'm reading you here being very sympathetic to how difficult this is. Is there something on the horizon where, I mean, we all know about drugs that have turned out very badly, Fen-Phen and others, related to weight loss. But is there something on the horizon that might actually, you know, help us have strong levels of the hormones that would help us take the weight off and keep it off in a way that's healthy? Is that out there, Dr. Leibel?
I think, you know, what's happening increasingly is a change in perspective on the treatment of obesity. And I think what's out there in the sense that you're talking about it is more emphasis on trying to understand what I would describe in a general sense as the biology of the weight-reduced state, this retention of body weight, this increased energy efficiency, this increased drive to eat, and to begin to address that from both a physiologic and a pharmacologic perspective will, I think, ultimately change the way that we handle obesity in individuals who need to maintain a reduced body weight. That is, allow them to lose the weight, help them to lose the weight yep. by conventional dietary means, but then actually begin very intensive efforts to, quote, treat the weight-reduced state so that they become more comfortable with it. And hormones like leptin and other drugs that aren't particularly effective at invoking weight loss mm-hmm. may be very effective in helping people at a reduced body weight.
Are companies working on that now? Is that,
companies are working on it. And I think one of the issues that needs to be addressed by the government, basically, mm-hmm. is you cannot license a drug or a treatment for the maintenance of reduced body weight. You can still only license a drug with the FDA for weight loss, not maintenance of reduced body weight.
But if what Tara's saying is right, you might need this drug for a long time because stop it and you could just shoot right back up.
That's exactly right. And I think Tara's absolutely correct. That's the analogy that we often use is if you manage to control your blood pressure with a drug or manage to control your cholesterol with a drug, you generally have to continue to take that drug indefinitely to keep the blood pressure down or the cholesterol down. We believe that ultimately the treatment of the weight-reduced state will require long-term interventions of this type, but the drugs that are efficacious may be quite different from the kinds of treatments that one would in the past have used to invoke weight loss.
You know,
I happen to think that's a much better target therapeutically mm-hmm. for all of the reasons that mm-hmm. are covered in this article.
What about, you know, the common attitude? Tara describes it. Here's one of our listeners on Facebook, Lou, says, as in most things in life, this resolve to lose weight, it's all about drive, determination, and character. Now, people struggle, and it's painful. And, you know, some reach acceptance And but many others, you know, for all the reasons Tara and everybody knows, they want to get it off. Is it some, I don't know, a bruise on our character if we end up using some leptin pill to keep the weight off? Are you sympathetic to that, Rudy, or not?
I think it's absolutely no bruise on anyone's character if you need some kind of pharmacologic help or other kind of assistance to maintain a reduced body weight, any more than it's a bruise on your character if you need a drug to keep your blood pressure down or your cholesterol down. These are all areas of medicine in which more and more effective therapies have been developed. Obesity obviously is well behind in this regard, but the fact that a person needs a drug to do this is no blemish on their character, I don't think.
Yeah, and how far, if there is a drug solution to keeping it off, is that a year away, 10 years away, nobody knows?
I don't think anybody knows. I think what's happened, though, is our perspective on the problem is in the process of being radically altered, mm-hmm. a la the kind of things I was just discussing, where we're now increasingly focused on helping individuals who've lost weight to maintain it, as opposed to simply looking for additional drugs that might produce weight loss per se. And I think that revolution, if you will, or change in perspective is going to pay off in terms of the development of agents that are much more effective in terms of helping to reverse some of the problems that are discussed in this article.
Let's take a call here from New York, South Glen Falls, New York. Tony, you're on the air, Tony.
Yes, thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you explored the idea of food additives as the original cause of some of these problems, that, you know, there's so many chemicals in the food for shelf life and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Does it affect the metabolism? And so your body can, you know, just store these things rather than use them, and whether that is something that should be explored rather than putting it on the people who have already been affected by it. It seems like, you know, it seems to me that foods have changed. I don't struggle with a weight problem, mm-hmm. but people around me and my family, even people, you know, that I share genetics with, have seemed to have more and more difficulty.
Let's look at that. Our time is short, but Tony, that's a great question. Dr. Leibel, how about it? Chemicals, food additives that might be part of the problem here?
Yeah, you know, the question of whether there are chemicals in the food that are enhancing weight gain or causing part of this problem is one that has attracted increasing interest. I think there is a possibility that some of the additives that are placed in food are certainly not helping the problem. My own thought is that more likely this is simply a result of a very small but error in intake versus expenditure, which is a result of changes in the environment in terms of easy access to highly calorically dense foods, mm-hmm. less need for physical activity. These other issues, such as additives in foods, may contribute a small amount in some instances, but I don't think they're the major factor.
Ellie in New Haven, Connecticut. Ellie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to call in real quick and speak to this idea of accepting a notion of health that would allow for overweight and obesity and a variety of body types. I think we too often substitute weight for health, and I think that we can't overestimate the positive health benefits of having someone able to take care of their body and be at peace with their body, even if that's a larger body. Thank you.
Ellie, I appreciate your call. I mean, Dr. Leibel, I'll come to you first on that one, and I'll come to you, Tara. But I mean, here we are as a country. We have so many people who are, by strict medical terms, whatever, overweight. And we hear about all the medical problems that come with that. You know, we have an urge to accept because so many people are in this case, and you don't want to make everybody miserable. On the other hand, there's the downside in health costs. How do you wrestle with that, Dr. Leibel?
Yeah, this is a very, very important point. And I think our perspective on this is that there are many people who are obese by the standards of the body weight curves, the body mass index, and so forth, who in fact have no medical consequence to this obesity. They don't have the high blood pressure, the changes in blood glucose metabolism, etc., that will accompany obesity in some individuals. And those who are healthy obese, as we sometimes call them, mm-hmm. I think should have much less pressure, feel much less pressure to reduce their body weight than individuals who have a medical consequence or complication of their obesity.
But and you studied diabetes, and look at our whole country. I mean, you know, nationally, we still got the problem.
Absolutely. So those individuals who are either highly at risk for developing diabetes or who actually have diabetes and are obese, those are the individuals in whom major emphasis should be placed on maintenance of reduced body weight. And I think it's important to emphasize that by reduced body weight, we don't necessarily mean return to what would be considered average weight for height or, quote, normal weight for height. We mean in often as little as a 10% reduction in body weight will rectify or substantially modify favorably something like blood glucose, elevated blood lipids, and blood pressure. And that should be the target, not return to some cosmetic norm that individuals often aim for when they're in the process of losing weight.
Rudolf Leibel, a doctor at Columbia University Medical Center. Tara Parker Pope, you've done a great service in helping us see all this. How does it leave you feeling, Tara? I mean, one listener says, I feel better. It's not 100% my fault, but at the same time, I'm discouraged. Where do you come down, Tara? Very quickly.
I don't think you should be discouraged. I think you should feel optimistic. This is not your fault. Just take care of the body you have. Exercise, enjoy your life, and do your best, but stop blaming yourself and just take care of your body.
Tara Parker Pope, New York Times, thanks so much. This is On Point.